to our next speaker. Addressing the implications, policy implications of the budget. Jennifer Doggett is probably well known to many of you. She's been a significant contributor to writing for a variety of publications, and she comes from, she's a fellow of the Centre for Policy Development, and she's now going to do that tiny task by selectively taking it apart in very small bits. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Tim. Luckily, I'm coming last out of the morning session, and we're running late, so I have the task of doing it very, very quickly. And luckily, most of the previous speakers have made all the points I was going to make much more eloquently than I have, so I won't rehash all of those points, but I will just quickly go through and pull out some of the key issues that have been made and maybe highlight some of the points that didn't come up this morning. I'm not going to go into huge detail about the budget because I think that's already been done to a large extent, and I know the people in this room are probably much more aware of all the issues arising out of the budget and the budget measures than I would be, but I will perhaps go through some of the underlying assumptions of the government and my experience in dealing with this government and government ministers on budget issues, some of the implications arising out of the measures both in the short and the long term for the health system, and also look at some advocacy opportunities that are coming out of this budget and perhaps look forward to what ACRA and other health stakeholders and individuals interested in health reform can take away from this and do in the future. So, as Peter Martin addressed very competently this morning, the budget was built on the perception and the idea that was propagated by the government that we are in crisis, that we do have a health funding crisis, that we're heading towards unsustainability if we can continue with our current patterns. And this is just two quotes from Dutton and Hockey, which reflects a lot of the rhetoric leading up to the budget. This is a graph similar to that shown by Peter this morning, showing that, yes, you know, health spending is growing, but it is very much in line with overall spending, and that the increase is very gradual and predictable, so it's not something that is likely to take us by surprise. This is, again, the demand. This is from the National Commission of Audit, and this is projected demand across our health system. So, again, what we're looking at, and obviously these predictions, as Peter said, are always a little bit dicey looking that far into the system, but even, you know, the National Commission of Audit has not suggested that there's going to be some unexpected leap that is going to suddenly spring upon us, so that we need to be taking drastic action now to address. Again, this is probably something you've all seen, that, as you know, Australia is not an outlier internationally. We do spend around the OECD average on healthcare. And for that, as a number of people have made already this morning, the point already this morning, that we do receive relatively good outcomes overall for that expenditure. And, I mean, clearly, as again, people have pointed out, the outlier there is the United States, which and the big difference between the US and the other countries is the size, the relative size of the private sector expenditure on health relative to public. So, as Peter said, I think what's important is to focus not on levels of expenditure, but on value and on affordability. And this is the graph, this is the sort of graph that we don't often see in the media. And what this looks at is the percentage in change of our health expenditure mapped against GDP. So taking GDP as a measure of what we're able to afford as a country, what we want to see to keep healthcare at the same level of affordability, what we want to see is that our health expenditure is tracking against our GDP. So as our GDP goes up, health expenditure may go up. If it goes down, then maybe health expenditure should go down. Now, as Peter again said, this does not mean that there is some, you know, fixed level of GDP that we need to spend on health. We have a choice as a country about whether we spend, you know, more or less, you know, as a quantum of money on health. And as Adam raised, we should be looking at value. We should be looking at what we're getting from the amount of money we spend rather than some arbitrary amount. But this certainly does undermine the idea that our current pattern of spending and our projected future patterns is sustainable. And as a contrast, this is the US situation. So there it's spending an increasing higher percentage of their GDP on healthcare. And just, you know, reminding you that this is not actual levels, this is percentage change. So as the percentage change tracks above the percentage of GDP, tracks above the percentage change in health expenditure, the actual levels get increasingly wider, and then you get the situation that you see in the other graph with the health expenditure overall of the US being rising in a much greater proportion to other countries. So to come back to the budget, as you know, I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail as on the individual budget measures. Some of the ones that have been discussed in the media and have been a focus of discussion and debate in the health sector are obviously the co-payments for primary care, both for GP pharmaceutical benefits and for associated tests, the role of private health insurance in primary health care. As we know, we're not entirely sure what the government's intentions are apart from comments they've made about the Medicare trial in Queensland. And Michael has maybe shed a little bit more light on what the private health insurance sector sees at its role, but there's still a lot of murky waters there. The role of Medicare locals and obviously changes to the way they're funded, the merging of them into primary healthcare networks and what that means for primary healthcare infrastructure, changing Commonwealth-state relations, including agreements around hospital funding and prevention, and I think Catherine King described those in quite a lot of detail this morning, and closures of some of the specific health agencies, so, for example, AMLA Health Workforce Agency, National Health Prevention Agency, and again, we still are not entirely clear about the implications of those closures for the specific functions of those agencies. So what specific functions will be continuing, say, within the health department, or what functions will be abolished. But coming out of the budget, obviously there has been a lot of debate and discussion about it, and you, I'm sure, would be aware of that. So these are some of the issues and concerns that have been raised in the media by health stakeholder groups, consumers and experts. So one of the main concerns is that the cumulative effect of these measures will be reduced access to care overall, in particular to preventative care and some cost-effective forms of care, particularly in the primary care sector. There have been a lot of concerns raised about the impact of those on different groups and the feeling that these measures will impact very differentially across the population and in particular impact upon people with chronic and complex conditions, on Indigenous Australians, widening the existing health gap, people with mental illnesses and people living in rural and remote areas, the people who are already experiencing poorer health outcomes and reduced access. A loss of say, corporate knowledge or knowledge of the sector, I think that's something that we can really underestimate with the loss of a number of people who's going elsewhere outside of the health sector. I think, you know, groups like AMLA, the Health Workforce Australia, they people that go and work there develop expertise in a particular area. These issues are very complex that we're dealing with, and I don't think we should underestimate the benefits and the contribution made by the people in those organisations who over time develop expertise in those areas, and that the loss of that expertise and knowledge is going to have on our capacity to drive reforms in the future. So obviously overall this is going to impact upon our health system capacity, in particular in relation to prevention and management of chronic disease, which is, as I'm sure you would all be aware, one of our greatest challenges and one of the best ways in which we can increase our outcomes and reduce expenditure in the future. over the long term some of the issues that have been raised in relation to the implications of the budget is overall increase in inequity of access to care, something that already exists within our current system but is likely to become worse. As Catherine King discussed, increased barriers to coordination across jurisdictions. Is partly, I think, due to the Commonwealth working away from some of its agreements with the state, but also as a result of a lot of organisations such as Medicare Locals Peak, AMLA, who played an important role in working with hospital sectors and supporting local organisations to develop programs and services that integrated care across those sectors. Unfortunately, what happens when a lot of money and resources are withdrawn and people go into more of a crisis mode is there's a focus on short-term, quick-fix solutions, so what's going to bring down the budget tomorrow, rather than what's going to increase value over the longer term. Some of the implications of increased co-payments are likely to steer consumers away from higher-value services towards lower-value services to avoid some of the upfront payments and that overall results in poorer outcomes and overall healthcare costs. And it's likely overall to widen some of the existing gaps within our community, so between Indigenous and non-Indigenous, between the rich and the poor, between rural and urban, some of those gaps that are already there. Again, this is probably a graph you've already seen, but just to reiterate that we're not working off a very high base in some of these areas, and while I think Catherine King's points about the progress that was made under Labor is to some extent true, it's also true that there are some problems that we have only really started to make inroads into, and some that really we have not made very much progress in at all. So for example, this is one of the Commonwealth Fund's regular surveys showing that Australians already have a high rate of reporting that they have not accessed treatment due to cost issues. Again, this is from AHW, their research on potentially preventable hospital admissions, showing that we spend a lot more than we need to on hospital care for people who could have accessed more cost-effective care in the community. Despite some of the rhetoric around people overusing free, in inverted commas, bulk billed services, there's whole groups of people, including men, which is a significant percentage of the population, who don't go to the doctor enough already. And again, this is something else that you would all know coming up from the College of General Practice around the cost effectiveness of GP services, and that really reiterates why we need to be focusing on strengthening and primary health care, making it more accessible rather than creating barriers to access within this sector. So in terms of dealing with the government on this issue, I think it's really important to understand how the government's approaching this issue, because in my reading of them, at least, is that it's very different from the way that most of us within the health sector look at health issues. And I think it can be quite difficult when you're trying to advocate and drive changes at a political level if you don't have a good understanding of where the other party is coming from. And I think we've seen that in a lot of the media discussions, interviews, and some of the meetings I've attended and presentations I've attended by Peter Dutton and some of his colleagues. There's a real disconnect, I think, between the messages he's getting through and some of the feedback he's getting from the health sector. So I think it's really important to understand that for the government, they've really approached the health sector as a budget issue. So the overriding drive, I think, for the changes is a concern about the budget and reducing the deficit. So, and the conception of the Commonwealth having a very narrow role, I think that's a big change from the previous government, who did see, and successive Labor health ministers did see their role as a leader of the health system overall, and that they had some responsibility to work with the states and to integrate the sectors and some leadership role across the spectrum of the health system. My impression so far of what I've heard from Peter Dutton and Abbott and Hockey is that they do not share that perception of their role. They see the role of the Commonwealth in the, Commonwealth in the health sector is much more closely defined. They're not really interested in hearing about flow-on problems in the hospital sector. And I mean, I'm sure some of you were at the press club address given by Dutton post-budget when some of the journalists asked him about the implications for the public hospital system of some of his changes, like the co-payment for primary care. And it was almost like he didn't understand the question. It was just not something that he thought was at all irrelevant to him as a Commonwealth minister. You know, that's a state issue. They need to take care of that, and they can use whatever levers, controls they have at their disposal. And I think that's a very different perspective from one which a lot of us in the health system have developed. And I think it's particularly different from one that a lot of consumers bring to the health system, where they see the health system as a continuum and do not see themselves as accessing a Commonwealth service or a state service, but just receiving, you know, healthcare. Obviously, all governments are ideologically driven to some extent, but I think it's really important to understand that the basis of a lot of this government's policy, in my opinion, is just a different view of society and community and individualisation. They really do see individuals as being much more self-determined and much more responsible for their own health and well-being, and much more in control of their lives than perhaps a lot of other people from the more social determinants of health perspective would agree. I think there's often a bit of a loss in translation when talking to the current government about social determinants of health, because in my experience they're not even sort of reading the same. It's almost like they're not even reading the same script when it comes to understanding how individuals. Actions are influenced by some of these structural issues, such as, you know, environment, wealth, social status, gender. There's very little understanding of that, and a concern with focusing on individual determinism, individual responsibility, and the capacity for people to operate independent of some of these determinants. And I think that's a very different perspective from a lot of us in the health system. But they have a very precise view of the public sector and public goods as a welfare system, and I think a belief that the government should only be funding public goods, whether that's health or education, as a sort of welfare type service, where the private system isn't able to do that, and a belief that the private sector, I think, does things inherently sort of better and more efficiently. And I think there's also a lack of understanding across government of just the complexity of the health system and how to change things, and a bit of a naivety, I think, about how easy it is to address some of these issues. I think sometimes I can identify the correct issue, but have as I said, a bit of a naive view about what it would take to change that, and a belief that, well, you know, the reason that some of these issues haven't been addressed is because they've been largely the preserve of the public system, and by handing them over to the private sector, we may, you know, they're suddenly going to come up with a much more efficient way of doing things, all these great ideas, and not be stuck in sort of the bureaucratic processes that they see as holding back the public system. So out of all this, I think there are some opportunities to increase advocacy and to drive some of these changes. So I think that as Catherine King said this morning, it has really created a focus on health in the media and within the community. I think that there are a lot of people outside of the health sector who are now engaged with health issues much more so than they had been previously. And I think that's a really positive development. I think it's really highlighted some of the underlying values of our health system and how we see health, how we see ourselves as a society. I think the government's been really surprised by the public reaction to some of their changes and the strength of support that Medicare has, which I think goes beyond just the convenience of being able to access a bulk billed service, but that a reasonable, you know, chunk of the community really does see Medicare as reflecting an Australian value or a bare community value. And that's something that we haven't really had a debate about within our community, and even, you know, Labor, for all its efforts in promoting health reform and looking at our health system through the Health and Health Bills Reform Commission, did not go and really open up the community debate about what underlying values do we want to inform our health system in the future. I think as well that the current focus on health has really promoted the use of new ways of engaging community and consumers in the health debate, so through social media, through blogs and other mechanisms. We're seeing a lot of new voices coming into the healthcare debate, which I think is a really positive development. We've heard a lot of consumer voices and consumer stories, which, you know, in the end, I think we all need to remember that, you know, that's what it's all about. It's consumer experiences. We've built alliances across different sectors of the health system that previously may not have been working very productively or cooperatively together. And I think it's also increasing political awareness among health stakeholder groups of the importance of the political process and of working within a political system. I think it's easy when things are going relatively well to forget that in a system that is still majority funded, you know, by public, that really health, you know, has to be political, and anyone that is playing a significant role or leading a health organisation really has to operate politically as well as within the, as a health leader. So I think here's some examples here of some of the community action, some of the things that have come out of the initiatives that have come out of the debate around healthcare, and these are from right across the spectrum of the health system, from doctors, from consumers, from community groups. And I would encourage everyone to be as involved as you can be in any or all of these initiatives and others, and make your voice heard. I think what I'd like to leave you with is some questions about where to from here. And hopefully we'll be able to discuss some of these over the next couple of days about, you know, moving forward from our current situation, how we can build on the passion and the energy in the community in support for Medicare in our health system, how we can ensure that the community and consumer engagement is sustained, and that we bring in many of these new voices and make them an ongoing part of our debate, how we can use some of these new ways of communicating and engaging with people and make them, again, a regular part of how we as insiders in the health system communicate and talk about what we're doing with the general community, how we can focus on underlying values, what we want from our health system, what we as a community are prepared to invest in it, and the trade-offs that we want to make, and ensure that all those important debates that Adam and Peter were talking about the level that we want to, the level of funding we want to put into health, the services that we think are good value, how we distinguish between good and bad value services, that consumer and community values and priorities really remain at the centre of that. Also important, I think, to broaden the discussion from some of the immediate issues, the $6-$7 co-payment, onto a more general discussion about how we fund healthcare. And yes, you know, the proposed payments are, you know, terrible policy and obviously should be opposed, but we also have a system of co-payments which is already unfair and inequitable and inefficient. So we don't want to sort of knock one, you know, $6 co-payment on the head and leave our current system intact. I think it's also important to embrace diversity and new ideas wherever they come from. And, you know, Michael's given us some really interesting input from private health insurance funds and their role. And I think it's very important that we don't reject solutions, whatever source they come from, just because we might not accept accept everything that the people promoting it believe in. I know Catherine King also mentioned Kaiser Permanente. Michael gave some really good examples of things that are happening overseas. Many of those things can be looked at in the Australian context without necessarily handing them to a private health fund or accepting the current funding system that we have at the moment. Our choice isn't between a sort of monolithic public structure and an American-style health system. We should be able to take the best in the world and include, you know, lots of new ideas and have diversity and choice within our current system without having inefficient funding structures. I think it's also important to look at the role of the health sector and how much more effective health stakeholders can be when they act in cohesion and cooperatively. It doesn't mean the health groups have to agree on everything, but that in terms of advocacy, some agreement is reached around what the key issues are and how action is going to be progressed on those. We've certainly seen the success of that through public campaign for public dental services, and how we as health, the people that care about the health system in whatever role, can become more effective advocates and play an important role in influencing our health system in the future. So hopefully we'll be able to address some of those issues over the next couple of days. I think ACRA does have a really important role in this debate, and all ACRA members, both individually and as part of ACRA, are making a really important contribution. And I hope that over the next couple of days we can develop some sense of where we want to go in the future and use some of the energy and momentum and focus that's up there at the moment to ensure that there is some benefit